Well, my name is Francis Chung, and today we'll be talking about developing Windows Store apps using C# and give you some background on the Kona project. Now, I wasn't initially going to be talking to you today. It was going to be Ward Bell. But Ward Bell couldn't make it today, so he graciously let me speak in his place. Anybody met Ward's sister? Well, actually, you're probably thinking his younger sister. Now, this is Nikki. She'll be the voice of the project team and our advisors today, so she'll be helping me out. Thanks, Nikki. Now, for the background of, the agenda. So we'll be giving some background on the Kona C# project, as well as giving you some tips and lessons learned that we acquired during the course of the project. Okay, but in order to understand the background of Kona, we have to go way back. We have to go way back to Prism. Any Prism developers here? A couple? About half. That's not bad. Not bad. All right. Well, when we started out the Prism project, we tried to tackle stories that our enterprise customers told us were important. For example, modularity, UI composition, region navigation, decoupled communication. So when you've got modules that are disconnected, how you get them to talk to each other. And you've got UI composition. If you've got modules that are disconnected, how do you contribute views with each other? So we tackled a lot of those problems for those types of customers. And commands and MVVM support were a natural fit. And we thought, well, this is great, but we kept getting requests to port it to Windows Store. We thought to ourselves, well, does that make sense to port something that was written for WPF and Silverlight, and also ported a little bit to Windows Phone to Windows Store? Does it make sense? So we took a look at some WPF apps. Now, granted, this is a web app, but I'm going to do a little test with you. Imagine this is a WPF app, right? I'm going to show you the Newegg version of the Windows 8 app and see if you can tell any differences, right? Is it going to be subtle? See if you can tell a couple differences. So imagine WPF, Windows Store. Let me do it again. WPF, Windows Store. Any differences? A couple? All right, my point is that the Windows Store apps are considerably different. The UI is different. Every page is different, with the exception of possibly hub-type pages where you've got more of an aggregation of content. Pages are usually single-focused. You're trying to do one thing. You're trying to convey one message. You're trying to acquire a bit of information. It's really straightforward and much cleaner than you typically see in a traditional application or a Prism application where things are really aggregated together, more loosely coupled, and you really don't know and really don't have complete control over how it's being composed. So we find that the type of UI composition that you see in Prism apps may not really fit. There may be a lot of other concepts that don't really fit. So when we asked to do a straight port, we said, well, let's go ahead and rethink this. So the Kona project is really just an end-to-end shopping app that uses C#, uses asynchronous programming, XAML, and .NET for Windows Store apps. We're projecting to ship in March 2013, but the focus here is to take those concerns of our enterprise customers, those line of business type needs, and apply them to Windows Store. So the fact that we're building a shopping app really just helps illustrate the point. Because, you know, we've all used shopping apps. We've all used shopping websites. So this is a known use case. And we're going to try to use that use case to apply to your line of business type scenarios. For example, UI composition. What does that mean? Forms over data you typically do in your enterprise apps. How do we do it? So we attempt to do those here. So we took Prism, and we tried to rethink them based upon what we've learned about Windows Store apps. And we said, well, what about modularity? Does that fit? Should we port that over? Well, modularity, in terms of Prism, is more about dynamic module loading. So we didn't really have the capability in Windows Store Apps. So I thought there is maybe some modular development. I can still go and write some different assemblies. We can package them together. But we didn't really have that same need for modularity, or at least that same capability. So we figured, well, modularity is not quite the same thing. UI composition? Well, maybe. You know, you still have some composition. You still have composition in terms of data. You still have the ability to pull data together, especially on a hub page. Again, it's an aggregation of lots of different types of content. You still have that type of thing. So maybe. Region navigation. Well, that was really tied back to the need to have modular development and be able to contribute views from different modules and have things light up. So we didn't think that region navigation was really that necessary. Decoupled communication, again, getting back to modularity, if you've got things that are decoupled, if you've got modules that don't know about each other, don't have references to each other, how can they talk? So that's when decoupled communication came up. But do we still have the need for decoupled communication in a case where all the assemblies can reference each other? I think we do. We have a couple of cases where we do. Commands and NVVM support is a pretty natural fit because they're both XAML platforms. Okay, let me give you a quick demo of our app. All right, so let's go and browse around. Here's our hub page. I'm going to take a look at a road bike. You don't see it yet, do you? Let me get out of that. Now do you see it? Come on. Maybe I've got to start it again. Don't even see my Visual Studio. That's not good. You see PowerPoint? Okay, you see PowerPoint. See my desktop? We're having some resolution issues. Let me change the resolution back to something that I think will know better. See if you see anything. That is not very happy. Well, at least PowerPoint works. Well, I'll go ahead and cut short my demo, but basically we have yeah, I don't see anything. Okay. So, okay. So basically, you've got a shopping app that has some forms over data. We need to capture forms. We need to do some validation. We need to be able to show data errors on the screen. How do you deal with that? How do you do some basic UI composition? How do you deal with view models and so forth and so on? And the app is available on CodePlex. Go ahead and take a look. But it's a pretty basic shopping app. The guts is really, I'll cover most of the guts in the deck. Okay, here's what you really came here to learn, the tips and lessons learned. Try to encapsulate it into 17 bullets or 17 slides. First one goes like this. Windows Store development is a lot like Windows Phone development. Any phone developers here? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Not bad. All right. So you guys will have an easy road to Windows Store development. A lot of the concepts that we've hit in Windows Phone development, for example, deactivation, tombstoning, and reactivation, very similar. Right? Suspending, terminate, resume is very similar. Now, in Windows Phone, especially Mango, you had this concept of fast app switching. Great idea. Basically, the idea was that, hey, when you deactivate, sometimes, or in Mango, most of the time, you get reactivated. You don't go into tombstoning. So your app needs to deal with that. You don't have to, don't assume that you're going to get tombstone and have to rehydrate every time. Don't go and load all your data every time. Because you know what? It could still be in memory. So just go ahead and jump back into your app. That's the same idea in Windows Store apps. You need to deal with it the same way. Now, of course, we've hit this problem before, so there's more infrastructure to help you with that. Next is the push notification. There's push notification on both platforms, slightly different service. For example, in the Windows Phone apps, you can call your push notification service as many times as you want, even unauthenticated. You're throttled, however, if you're unauthenticated. So, you know, if you're testing your app, you can go and push messages to it, and you don't have to be fully authenticated. For the Windows push notification service, for the Windows Store apps, you have to be authenticated. So in order to talk to that service, you have to provide it the credentials of your specific app. So that's a little bit different, but same concept, same workflow in terms of how to get a message to your device, same thing. The certification process is also very similar. You can't just go ahead and write an app and deploy it. You have to push it into some sort of marketplace or the Windows Store. So you have to go through some sort of certification. So both have certification processes. Windows Store apps have a certification process for the user experience. That's the Application Excellence Review. And we'll be going through that next week, as a matter of fact. Next is the App Manifest Declarations. So every app has the need to, or has the capability of showing to the user, hey, this is what I need. I need to talk to the network. I need to talk to the Wi-Fi. These are things that, or talk to GPS, these are things I need to run. And as a user who wants to download and install that app, hey, this is what the app needs. Okay, I'll let them do it. I'll install it. So both have that same concept. Next thing is focus on attached behaviors. Now, if you've done any XAML programming, especially in Silverlight 2 or 3, you've done a lot of work with attached behaviors, right? You create an attached property on something and you give it behavior. So that's an attached behavior. Well, in Windows Store apps currently, there are no blend behaviors. The blend SDK is not available, so beware of that. Also, there are no binding expressions. Now, you can go ahead and create a binding expression in XAML, but you can't get access to it from another attached property, so beware of that. So the attached behaviors is where it's at. Go ahead and write your dash behaviors just like you did back in Silverlight 2 and 3. Okay, so that'll become very, very useful. Next thing is push notifications. Now, in Windows Store apps, it's imperative that you register your app with the Windows Store in order to communicate with the Windows push notification service. Okay, so once you register with the store, you'll get an SID, as well as a secret key. With that secret key, you can now push messages through the push notification service. If you have a purely sideloaded app, anybody know what sideloading means? You heard that term? Okay, a couple. So the idea here is that you're an enterprise customer. You wrote an app that you want to put on your internal server and you deploy to your internal people. That's what a sideloaded server would be. Well, if you don't register your app with the Windows Store, you won't be able to use push notification. So be wary of that. Next is async and await. Now, Chris Tavares is going to talk a lot more about asynchronous programming, but I'll just go ahead and give you a quick intro here. Async and await are definitely really powerful. When you're working in Windows Store apps, you're going to see that all of the API calls that deal with web services, the file, IO, anything that might take any time, amount of time at all those are going to be asynchronous calls. All those calls are going to return you a task of something. Could be a task of string, task of a payload. And so just get used to it. And so you can see here we've got a method that is an asynchronous method. You can see by the signature as well as the convention, when you've got an asynchronous method, you typically put async at the end of the method name. We create an instance of the HTTP client, and we call getString async, passing in a URL. And that call returns a task of string. And what is this task of string? A task of string is something that will return you a string in the future. It's going to give you the string when it's done processing. You don't know yet when it's done. And as a matter of fact, you can see here, after line 4, it almost immediately returns with line 5. So now you have a handle to something that will return you a string. We will go ahead and do the independent work. And then when we hit line 7, we'll go and await for that process to finish. So when that string is available, then I want to continue on to the next line, which is line 8, and get the length of that string. So you don't want to get the length of the string until the length of the string is available. So you can see here, we're holding on to that processing. Now we're not blocking the UI thread. The UI is still responsive, but this processing, line 8, just will not happen. The rest of that method will not happen. And this is really a cool compiler feature that's available to us. All we have to do is put await in your method, and the rest of your method will not proceed until the results of that task are complete. So, very powerful. Question?
Is it any different than task.value?
Task.value.
Yeah, like a task that returns a strongly typed result. You get a value from it. Block. Is await different than that?
Yeah, I think in that case, like for example, task.value, and I think task.await. I think those actually block.
Okay.
I think those actually block the UI thread. In this case, await will basically take the rest of this method and not complete it.
Okay.
And basically put it into a little delegate and say, look, I'm going to run that when this is done. I'm not going to block the UI thread. So it kind of does that work for you. Now, normally, in old school, you would actually take the rest of that method and put it into some sort of callback, right?
Yeah.
Right. No, you don't have to do that here. You just put that await, and the rest of that method will go ahead and be put into the delegate for you.
Okay.
Let's talk about pages and navigation. Let's first talk about pages navigation in a code-behind type world. I'll be talking a lot about model view model later on, but let's just talk about in the code behind world and really what you get out of the box when you do a file new project using either the grid or the I think split. I forget the other template. But our next tip is to use the layout aware page. It's very powerful. It provides you a lot of functionality. It provides navigation support, visual state switching, and process lifetime. What do I mean by that? Well, if you want to go and navigate, for example, back or forward or home, the layout aware page provides that for you. Okay. Now, if you take a look at those first 5 methods, they're kind of funny looking methods, right? Those aren't methods you typically call by yourself. Those are actually event handlers. And so I'll show you an example of how you're supposed to invoke that in your XAML to go back or go home and so forth. Also talk about the load state and save state, which are really important. Now, one thing that I'm not a huge fan of that layout aware page has is that they've got their own concept of view model in it that doesn't match my understanding of view model. So in my version of the layout aware page in the Kona project, we actually call it the visual state aware page because really that's all I needed to do. But we basically harvested that content out of the layout aware page. Okay. So if you want a button that just goes back, that uses that method in the layout aware page, all you have to do is this. Button click equals go back. Now you typically have an event handler for click. So in this case, you're using the go back event handler. And the functionality for going back and dealing with the frame and seeing if you can go back is all taken care of here. Okay, well in this case, you're binding the can go back functionality is bound to the frames can go back function. Also the user control. If the user control needs to be able to deal with the state or the visual state updates, this is how you do it. So you've got the load and unload events. You're now tying them to the start layout unload, start layout updates and so forth. Those event handlers that I mentioned here. Okay, so that's why they look like event handlers, because that's how you're intended to consume them. Next, let's talk about load state and save state. These are really important for Windows Store apps, because when you're in a Windows Store app, you need to be able to stash away your page state. When you get suspended, you have a very small amount of time to put away any page state you have. For example, let's say you've got a page worth of data. Users provided, you know, created all this content for you. And when they suspend, let's say you just swipe away, that causes the suspend event. You have a very small amount of time to put that information away. Do you have time to call web service? No. Do you have time to maybe write it to maybe a database? Not really. You don't have a lot of time to put that stuff away. You really have just enough time to capture any page state you have and just quickly put it away. We have the ability within the layout aware page to use something that's also provided within the comment or within the template called the suspension manager. That helps manage all this. It keeps track of your page stack, where you are, a lot of your typical page state that you need. So that takes care of that. Let me show you how you would use that. So your save state method here is something that it's discoverable. You just create your own page deriving from layout aware page, and you just do an override, and boop, you see save state and load state. So you just go and override them, and I provide my own specific business logic as to what I want to save away. So here I've got a visual stack panel that I'm going to find because I have to go and walk the visual tree. So I'm getting the virtualizing stack panel. I'm getting the horizontal offset of that stack panel. And if my demo worked, you'd see this. So if I were to go from one page to another and come back, I need to be able to save that state. So the scroll position you need to preserve, right? If you've scrolled a lot and you navigate away and you can navigate back, you don't want to be at the beginning. You want to be where you scroll to, right? So that's something that we run up to quite a bit in Windows Store apps. You potentially have a lot of scrolling. You want to preserve that scrolling. So this is what you do. You go ahead and grab the horizontal offset and stash it away. So we've got a page dictionary here. We put it in that page dictionary. And that's it. The suspension manager, after this is done, will go ahead and take that persisted away. And when you load, when the load state method gets called, you can pull it out and then use it. You can see here, I'm just pulling it out of the page state dictionary again. And then at that point, I can go and set it back into my virtualizing stack panel's offset. Any questions about that? So again, this is out of the box. You get file new project, you get load, you get the layout aware page, and this is how you use load state and save state. Pretty straightforward. Next tip is that you definitely have to support your different visual states. When you've got a Windows Store app, and you've got a Surface, for example, you can go from your full page landscape to portrait in a heartbeat. And if it looks terrible, you're going to know very quickly. Also, you can get snapped. You can take your app, drag it to one of your sidebars, and your app will get snapped. You cannot stop your app from getting snapped. You can very easily get put into a snap view, which looks kind of like a condensed version of your portrait mode. So you need to support that. You also need to support your field mode, which is kind of a condensed version of your full. So basically, you've got your visual state manager, which is defined in your XAML for each page, and you've got storyboards for each one of these states. Typically, we first design for your full landscape view, and then we have storyboards for showing how you want to show the other views. For example, in your landscape view, you might show a grid view, something that typically spans or you can scroll left and right very easily. In a snap view or a portrait view, you typically will use a list view, something that scrolls up and down more easily. So a storyboard might look like, well, I'm going to go and hide the grid view, show the list view, something like that. You can move things around very easily in the storyboard. So you'll get used to seeing these different visual states. I believe so.
You said they all will require all those states in every page?
You don't have to define them. If you don't define it, then you won't have anything that will happen in that state. your app will go into that state. And if you don't define anything you want to change, well, your landscape view will then be forced into whatever state you will have. Okay. All right, let's talk about world readiness. Very important. Your app, assume that you get it into the Windows Store. People from all over the world will be able to download it. So you want to make sure you're world ready. What does world ready mean? Well, it means that your calendars have to look right, your currency has to look right, and definitely your localization. So let's talk about localization. You can see here, it's a little bit different than you typically see in a typical .NET app. Here we've got a strings folder. We've got different folders for each locale. And within each one of those folders, you've got a resources res.w file. And you can see here the contents of the res.w file and how you'd consume it. Now, the first line, let's take a look at that. The preview cartoonized app bar button tooltip content. Ooh, that's a mouthful. So you can see some localized content there. And you can see the tooltip XAML down below. The UID is set to a name for that control. And you can see that the resource information refers to the content property. So you can see that the content property is also provided here in the XAML. And that's really useful for design time experience. So if you want to see that content show up in your designer, I would go ahead and put it in line. But at runtime, if you're in one of those locales, that content property will get overridden by what's in the resource file. Okay? So it's pretty straightforward, really, really easy to use. Next, basically the rest of my talk will be talking about the model view, view model pattern. Anybody familiar with that pattern? Basically everybody, all right. So I'm not going to try to preach to the choir here. If you're concerned about maintainability, testability, this is a very, very popular pattern, right? Let's talk about navigation. Now, you're in your view model. You're in some business logic, and all of a sudden you decide, you know what? I'm done here. I need to move to another page. I need to go into another experience. I want to go to the item details of a specific product. What does that navigation call look like? Does it look like the view first type approach, where I'm in my view model and I say, well, I'm done here, I want to go to the view? Does the view model know about views? Any fans of that? View first? No? Boy, crickets. No fans of view. Oh, we got one. What about view model first? Does the view model know about other view models? Does the view model say, hey, I'm going to construct the next view model I want to go to. I'm going to go and set it with whatever it needs to know. Then I'll go to it. Any fans of that? One fan. Two fans. All right. Boy, it doesn't seem like we have a consensus here. What did we do? Well, we harped on this for at least a week within the team room. Which way? View model first, view first, and we took guidance from some of the MVVM frameworks out there too, trying to figure out what they liked, what the people who liked those frameworks liked. Here's what we did. Nikki says, neither. We're going to go with a string-based approach like URLs. Hey, we've dealt with those before, right? Those are basically an abstraction over a resource. Hey, I can deal with that. So in this case, we believe that the view model shouldn't really know about a specific view. I think that would be, personally, I have fits thinking about that. But should a view model know about another view model? I'm still not sure about that, especially if you want to do decoupled programming, decoupled development. I don't know if my module should know about your module. I think we should know that I want to go to the next experience. I want to go to the item details. I'm not sure where that is, but I want the system to navigate me there. So we went with string-based navigation, as you can see on the right. Next point is to use the bindable base. Actually, this is MVVM. All our view models extend bindable base. And bindable base is great. It's really simple. It's a basic implementation of iNotify property changed, as you can see here. This is the entirety of the code. If you take a look at the bindable base that's in your common folder when you do finally a project, this is all there is, with more comments, of course. Basically, all you do, all it does is provide the property change event, which is specified in the iNotify property change interface, but it provides you a method called setProperty. SetProperty checks to make sure the property has changed. For example, the property you're trying to set, is it different than the old subproperty? If it is, then I'll set it. If it's not, I'm not going to do any more. I'm not going to try to raise the event. I'm not going to do any more. That's very important because you don't want to have too much communication between your view model and your view. If you're raising events every time, even though the value hasn't changed, it can cause some problems. It's definitely going to cause a lot more chattiness between the view and view model. Next is view model location. Now, when we first wrote the sample app that we did, and frankly, a lot of the apps I've written for the XAML stack have very simple view model locator, right? How many people have done this? You just have a static class with static properties, one property for view model, and that property returns you a fully constructed instance of that view model, right? And you bind to that in your view. Okay, that works. That works. But it's going to be specific to your app every time. You're going to have to rewrite this every time. You're going to have to maintain it every time. So what we decided to do is take a look at what is already provided by a lot of the MVVM frameworks out there. And what was really popular was more of a convention-based lookup. So let's say your page is called MyPage, and it's in a specific namespace. Well, it would be nice if I just said, hey, I want to use the ViewModel locator, go get it for me. Go and hook up my ViewModel for me, please. And since I'm my page, go ahead and use convention-based. And so the convention would be that the ViewModel would be in the my name space dot my page view model. So if that were the case, go ahead and take care of everything for me. All I have to do is make sure my view models are in the same namespace. That's an example convention. You can, with the Kona view model locator, you can provide the convention. You can also override the convention with any exceptions to the rule that you might have. For example, the way we have it in our code base is that we actually don't use convention at all. We actually provide a list, a mapping. Hey, if you're this view, here is a delegate to create, or basically a factory to create the view model for it. And so in our case, we don't use a container. Kind of shocking, isn't it? We're actually not using container in this example. But we thought we don't really need a container. For the level of composition that we're doing, we're not using container in our code, Kona reference implementation. But you can. You can. Again, as I mentioned, we've got a mapping that maps a view to a factory that will pump out the view model for you. You can easily hook up a container to provide that resolution for you, to do that instantiation. And so all you have to do in your view to hook up to your view model to use the Kona view model locator is the attached property you see above. If you set that equal to true, our view model locator will try to find the view model for you and set it into the data context of the view. Pretty straightforward. Okay? Any questions about that? Validation. Let's talk validation for a little bit. That's one thing that we definitely thought was a little different with your enterprise line of business type applications over your typical content consumption apps is validation. I mean, you're going to have forms over data, right? That may not be the only thing that's specific to LOB enterprise applications, but that's definitely one thing. So we definitely tackled that. Now, how did you do it before? In WPF and Silverlight, you typically will implement iNotify data area fill, and then your UI controls will bind to the errors collection that's specified in the iNotifyDataError.info if the notify on validation error is set to true. Pretty slick. For example, that you can see the text box here, it uses that property. However, that's not available in Windows Store apps. So, just to let you know, our recommendation is to use our bindable validator. So here you can see that we've got the same text box. I'm bound to the address, first name, mode two-way, just so you can write and pull. But we have an attached property or attached behavior that will highlight that text box, put a little red around it. If the property errors is bound to something that has any data in it, right? And that data is bound to errors first name. So I've got an errors property on my view model, and it's got an indexer on it and says, hey, it'll return you any data if there's data in the first name. So if there is, that text box will turn red. Okay? And in my view model, I just expose my bindable validator. Bindable in that it's easy to hook up with XAML. Validator meaning that it uses the data annotations validator to actually perform the validation. But you can create your own validator if you want. But ours just happens to use the data annotations validator. And it exposes the errors property for bindability. Now, this requires a couple things of the model that we're trying to validate, the address model in this case. It requires that it's INPC, right? Because we're exposing the model to the view. We actually had a lot of talk about this in the team room. Should we expose the model to the view? Should we wrap it? We had a lot of talk about this. But in this case, we're exposing the model. You can see the address property. We're exposing it. And so when you change the first name, how do I know? I don't know. I don't know unless the address is INPC. So that something is listening to it, they can do the validation. So in this case, the bindable validator does the listening. So all I have to do is create an instance of the validator passing in the model, and that assumes that the model is validatable, as in it's got some data annotations on it, and that it's INPC. And if it fulfills those requirements, that will go ahead and create errors in the errors dictionary that you can bind to. Any questions about that? No? So, yeah, I think this will be very useful. Got a question up there, yes.
Visual state of the UI element through the validator. Say you have an error state, say you've got a custom control, for example, and you want to have an error visual state on that custom control, or you have one. Is there any way for the, obviously you can extend it to do it on the validator, that it forces the control into that error state when an error does occur?
Right. That's a good point. We haven't delved into that much, but that's natural extension. Natural extension. Basically, that would require us to extend text box to have these visual states. But yes, that would be the natural extension. So far, the attached property is very simple. All it does is add a little bit of red chrome around it.
Or you could just apply a style.
Right. 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 But the highlight form field on errors, we tried to make it more general purpose. So you could use it, but you can feel free to use it and adapt it to your specific app if you've got a specific error style that you want to deploy and so forth.
Every application
would have a specific error style. Right. So it's hard for us to define that for you. But yeah, you absolutely can. We consider that. Next thing is decoupled venting. Any users of Event Aggregator in Prism? One? A couple? Okay. Okay, I thought that was one of the more popular features. Oh, Glenn up there. Okay, so that was one of the more popular features in Prism. And that was one of the things that people asked us to port over and over again. Every advisory call, when are you going to port Prism, the event aggregator? I said, well, I'm not proven. It hasn't been proven to me that we need it. Every time we said, well, can that be handled? Can that communication be handled by direct method invocation? You know, can we do this simpler? Do we need decoupled eventing. And every iteration we came up and we kept avoiding it. No, we can do it simpler, we can do it simpler. But now we believe we have a scenario within the Kona reference implementation that requires the event aggregator, and here it is. Anybody heard of the Hollywood parent UI composition? Hollywood parent? One. Really? I was on the Prism team for a long time, but I've only heard about it like a month ago. Somebody mentioned to me, oh, use a Hollywood parent. Like, Hollywood parent? What's Hollywood parent? Sounds like a bad Kardashian episode or something. I had no idea what Hollywood parent was. They said, whoa, that's the case where the parent doesn't really know about its children, doesn't talk to its children. Get it, Hollywood parent? Yeah, like, wow, okay, that's great. Yet another pattern, that's great. Well, this case we actually have in the UI, in the RI. And the case is very simple. We have a little widget thing, a little user control that we put on a lot of the pages that shows you how many items are currently in your shopping cart, right? It needs to go and get its own data. The parent of that page doesn't know anything about it. It's like, oh, you go and do your thing. I'm not going to provide you any data. You just go do your thing. And all we do is add that user control in XAML. So the parent user control, the parent view model knows nothing about the child view model. They don't communicate at all. The parent can deal with navigation to and from. It can be disposed. The child doesn't really know. It just kind of shows up. So in this case, the child view model, again, that little shopping cart user control, it needs to go and get access to the shopping cart repository. It's a long-lived service. And say, hey, shopping cart repository, let me know when you change. If somebody adds an item to you, let me know. So what do we do? Well, we just went ahead and hung an event off that repository. That worked. Yay. Next task. Uh-oh. What just happened? Anybody? What happens when the little thing connects to an event off a long-lived service and doesn't connect, doesn't unconnect? What happens? Memory leak. Thank you very much. Christopher, get him a prize. Memory leak, exactly. So now, since we don't have the ability to unhook, we have a memory leak. I tried very hard to find a case where we could unhook so we didn't have to do this, but now we do. So we went ahead and ported the Prism event aggregator for the specific scenario. Initially, it was designed for decoupled eventing, so you didn't have to know about each other. But it has the feature of having weak references to all of its listeners. So the listener can go be disposed without having to worry about having to unhook. Okay? So use the event aggregator. And here's a simple case where you've got the subscriber, something that wants to listen to an event. It takes a dependency on the event aggregator. And in the constructor, I just go ahead and get the event and subscribe to it, passing in a delegate of what I want done when that event gets executed. And then you've got a publisher, again, similar. I'm taking a dependency on the event aggregator, and at the appropriate time, I'm calling publish with a payload. Pretty straightforward, okay? That's how the event aggregator is used. Let's talk about commanding next. Commands. I've talked to several advisors in our Kona project who are, they hate commands. They hate commands. I thought, how can you hate a command? Come on, it's a simple thing. Here's the interface. You can execute some code. You can check if that code, that command is executable. You can also tell the system that, hey, the executableness of that command has changed. So update yourself. He said, it's way too much. I don't care about that stuff most of the time. Most of the time, I just have a method on my view model I want to call. So you're going to throw away commands for that? So, well, I believe there is a time and place for commands, and there's also time and place for direct method invocation. And I definitely heard the advisors' complaints, and in a lot of cases, where you have invokers, for example, the button base that work with commands, it is compatible with command. You can set a command and a command parameter to it, and that button will get highlighted and disabled based upon the can't executableness of that command. That works great. But in all the other cases where you don't, you just have something you want to click on and you want to go. You want to hit that method. You don't need a command for that. So don't use a command. So what we've decided to do is use commands where they're appropriate. For example, here you've got a button. It's bound to a shopping cart navigation command. In the view model, I've got the command implemented as a delegate command, passing it first what I want to do when that command is executed. That's the first parameter. Can navigate to shopping cart is the check. And finally, I can, at some point in my business logic, say, hey, that shopping cart navigation command changed. For example, the user added an item to the shopping cart. You can navigate to the command now. You can go to the shopping cart. If they didn't have anything in the shopping cart, maybe I don't want you to go to the shopping cart page. Okay. So that functionality is great if you're dealing with buttons. Everything else, we recommend just go ahead and use an attached behavior like the following. In this case, we want to have the item clicked of a grid view item do some sort of navigation. In this case, for a grid view, in order to get it to respond to an item click, you have to set a couple things. You have to set selection mode equals none, as well as is item clicked equals true. When you set those, then the item clicked for the selected item will get fired. So in this case, we've got an attached behavior called the list view item clicked to action. And we bind the action to an action that we have in the view model. And when I'm saying action, I'm actually saying the keyword action. And in the view model, you can see here, I'm just setting that action to the name of a method that I want to call, an action style method. And that's it. I don't care about the can executeness. So this is a lot simpler, a lot cleaner. You don't have to worry about all that other infrastructure in order to just get a piece of code to run on my view model. Okay? So we believe that is cleaner. Next, let's talk about suspend, resume, and terminate. Now, we talked about this before in the context of the code behind. In code behind, you need to be able to deal with the loading and saving of state. So we provide those two virtual methods in your layout aware page. So all you have to do is extend layout aware page in your code behind, boom, you got two methods you can use, right? Well, what about in view models? How do you handle this termination, suspension, and resumption in your view model? How do you do that? I mean, how do your view models know when it's being terminated? How do you do that? Well, one way to do that is have the view, which knows about all these events, go ahead and pass them to your view model. Anybody use that technique? Anybody? You got one? Okay. It's a clean technique. Hey, nothing wrong with it, right? The view knows what's happening, so it just informs the view model, hey, I need to persist my state. Hey, I need to save my state. Hey, I need to go ahead and load my state. So the view model doesn't have to know anything, just needs to be told what to do, right? But we decided, well, let's provide a little more framework for you guys, a little more help. So here's all you have to do to save some state and to recover from that state using the Kona MVVM framework. So for example, you've got your view model. It extends our base view model. And it also has this marker interface, iNavigation aware, saying that, hey, I care. I need to respond to changes in navigation. When it's time to load state, let me know. When it's time to navigate away, let me know. When I get navigated to, let me know. So I care about navigation. I've got one property, one public property, and I put a restorable state attribute on it. So what'll happen is that when this view model is navigated away from, the value of name will get stored away. When this view model gets navigated to, the value of name will be pulled from the page state that I mentioned before, that again, we're using the same suspension manager as we are in the layout aware page. That data is pulled out of the suspension manager and set into this property. All you gotta do is put that attribute on it. That's all you gotta do. Now, let's say that property wasn't just a string. Let's say it was a collection of strings, an observable collection of strings. This will still work. Let's say you had a private setter on that collection of strings. This will still work. We're actually using reflection in order to set the value, so those will still work. The only thing you'll have to do, though, is you'll have to train the suspension manager. There is also a method for that. It needs to know the exact types it needs to serialize and deserialize. So there's just like one call, like suspension manager dot known types dot add. So you just have to add the observable collection of string. So it then will know how to serialize and deserialize those. All right, any questions about this? No? All right. So definitely recommend this. After we started doing this, all of our view models use the restorable state. And all of a sudden, suspend, resume, terminate work beautifully. Next thing is unit testing. Unit testing, I'm a big advocate of unit testing, TDD, so forth and so on. In Windows Phone 7, Jeff Wilcox came up with the Silverlight unit test framework, loved it. It went ahead and ran your unit tests on the metal in your device or in an emulator. It was great. You actually saw your unit test running where it's supposed to. You know, it'd be nice if the unit test ran on your desktop, but you know, are you sure that actually it will run correctly on your devices? You're not really sure. But these actually ran your unit tests on your devices or on your emulator. One challenge, though, is how do you get the content of those test runs off the device or the emulator, right? Let's say I had two failures. How do I get that off? We actually provide that guidance in our Windows Phone for Mango guidance. We actually show you how to pull that content off and incorporate it back into your test runner, for example. But in Windows Store apps, this is all taken care of for you. This is really slick. You can actually run and debug your unit test right from the IDE. Set a breakpoint in your Windows Store app, hit run or debug your unit test, it will hit it, which is something you wouldn't get with Windows Phone. So that is definitely an enhancement. Also, you can harvest the contents of the test run from a command line. So for example, here's the lines from my MS build file to do that. So I've got these test app packages. So I identify the appx files that I want to execute. Next thing is I call RS test console exe against each one of these appx files. And I specify the logger. I say, hey, when you run, go ahead and give me the results in a TRX format. And they're there. It's just that easy. Just that easy. Any questions about that? All right. Next is the file system. Now, I think Christopher Banage is going to talk a lot more about the file system, because in the Hilo project, they use the file system a lot more extensively to do queries and to be notified on changes to the file system. But I just want to let you know that the file system, there's a lot more facets to it. For example, if you want to do relational databases, SQLite is your answer. Next, if you want to use roaming data, which is a great feature, roaming data means that if you have a device that's connected, you've got a connected Microsoft account, you've got another device that's also using that same connected account, and also you have to make sure you approve all these devices that you're connecting. Once you've got all these connected devices, you set some roaming data. That roaming data will get populated to all of your other devices. It's a nice feature. You can also have high priority roaming data. So for example, you can tag your roaming data with high priority tag on it, and if it is less than 8K, it will get there very quick. It'll get there very quick. For example, if I had a file, maybe 50K in roaming data, it may take 5-10 minutes. I've noticed that's not bad, 5-10 minutes. But high priority could take more like 5-10 seconds to get pushed across. So that's a really nice feature. There's also password vault, so that keeps your credentials encrypted and safe and secure in your file system. Now, I want to talk a little bit about roaming data, though. We thought, well, boy, this is such a great feature, let's use it. Let's use it for everything. So anything I wanted to pass around, hey, why store it up in the cloud? Let me just roam it. right? It doesn't work that well in for those scenarios. For example, if I wanted to store my shopping cart in roaming data, and then I went to another device, and I want to load that up. Boy, I still got 5 or 10 minutes before it's going to come across. What do I do in the meantime? The user's there, they added more things. Well, this is just too complicated. So we believe that our guidance here, point 17, although it's a little bit hidden, is that if you have mission-critical data that you want to store and you want to retrieve in a specific time that you really know, you really want to have control over when you get and can store that data, just do it through probably a web service, you know, the old-fashioned way, the way you typically do it. But if you have things like preferences, other information like style, color choice, other information that you may not need immediately, like, for example, for our app, we have your list of previously shipped to addresses, right? You don't need that immediately. That can be stored in roaming data. For example, our password vault is also roaming, so that can move around as you go. So there's definitely a case with roaming data, definitely high priority roaming data, but there's still a case if you have mission critical data you need to get at a specific time, go ahead and use the old fashioned web services for that. Any questions about that? All right, so I've got, again, our code, our project will be done probably end of March. Sorry, around the middle of March, we're hoping to be done at the end of February. Is that still right, Blaine?
That's the hope.
All right. My name is Francis Chung. Here's my email address if you have any other questions. Actually, let me entertain any last questions. Come on. Don't tell me I answered all of your questions. Oh, we got two. Please.
Is there a good mocking framework for testing on WinRT?
Not that I know of right now. Not that I know of. We considered... This is an interesting story. In our project, we considered using portable libraries, so we could use the mocking frameworks available to the portable libraries. But then there's some question as to, we're actually running those tests against those libraries. How am I sure that they're going to run as I expect on the device? So that was a question. So all of our mocks are handwritten, although we use the style of a lot of the mocking frameworks. For example, for every public member that we expose in our API or in any of our testable things, we make sure to provide a delegate that you can provide behavior. So that's exactly what most of the mocking frameworks do. You provide an interface, and for every public member, they create a delegate. And then you can just train it with everything you expect. So we have manually created these mocks that the mocking framework would have done for us. So we think we're still following that style, and if there's a mocking framework that's provided for us, we probably will have to do very little work to migrate to it. But currently, I don't know of any. Okay? You had other questions back there?
Do you have like a transitive view model state where you navigate just by passing information back and forth? So when you say like something that's modal, you're just passing a state in and then a state back out from that navigation context?
Generally, yes. So for example, in a navigation call, we have a parameter, an object parameter that we pass to the next thing, and the next thing is expected to know what to do with that. So that's currently what we're doing.
You can't handle any sort of parent-child validation through modality unless you're passing the entire parent and all the relative information. Because you're doing it by convention. So you need to pass in everything that you need for the state for that modal state.
So I'm confused as to your question about validation and passing state.
So say you need to validate something. You're going into a modal navigation, you're going out. So you're saying that you need to pass in any relative information for that modal view with that through the navigation.
So the question is around navigation. What do we have to pass to the next view in order for it to... Right, so the question, I think, was around modal views.
Modality,
Right, but around modality. So how do you deal with modal views? How do you pass all the context in that it needs to do, and how do you get that context out? I don't think we've actually dealt with any modal views, and I'm not exactly how much support we have for modal views. In general, we have certain limitations in how much we can block the UI. So I'm not sure how much. We haven't run into that scenario. So the question is around modality. How, if you were to navigate something, then the only direction you have is to go back out. We haven't run into that situation. But in general, when we do navigation, we just provide an identifier, typically a string or an int, to specify what I'm interested in next. So the item detail page, if I pass it a certain ID, the item detail page expects that to be, that's going to be an item ID. So I'm going to go and look up in the repository what that item is going to be. So we don't typically pass very much more than that in our navigation calls. So we haven't run into that scenario. Yes, please.
Any guidance around a disconnected or casually connected client where you need to sync data back and forth? Because obviously your shopping cart app, eventually, it's not an island, so it eventually needs to go back to some centralized.
All right, great question. Thanks for the question. Question was about offline scenarios, synchronization. We haven't really dealt with that very much. In our app, what we've done is we've provided a little bit of offline experience in that we cache all the content. So when you're browsing around the product catalog, everything you've seen, we go ahead and cache that locally. So that if you go disconnected, you can still go back to those pages. However, like as you mentioned, let's say if I were to allow the user to manipulate their shopping cart offline. Right, we've got this product catalog, they've seen, let's say, downloaded all of it, now they can manipulate it offline, and then when they go online, how do we synchronize that? We haven't dealt with that scenario yet. That might be, I'm not sure if we're going to hit it in this project or not, but that's definitely a very interesting scenario. Anything else? All right, thank you very much.